So just to get started,
conference record has joined the conference.
So well, I just got a song here, but so to get started, I'm talking about FOG, and I'll get back to what that means. But for your information, I run a couple blocks, and it's stephanlindegaard.com, which is more on thought leadership. And then I run a blog on 15 Inno, which is on the topic that we should discuss here today. And 15 Inno is a place where I have my own thoughts and ideas on open innovation. But I also try as much as possible to spread the word in general, bring in views from others, and also do this on my Twitter account. So I see myself very much as a facilitator on open innovation and trying to spread the word and why this is relevant and help companies adopt open innovation. I've recently written a book, and I think we heard that a couple of times, but you can see that on the website as well. On the website, I'd just like to point out one thing, and that is that if you see on the upper right corner, open innovation examples and resources. This is a blog post I wrote some time ago, and it has lots of corporate examples on how companies actually adopted in more or less successful ways to adopt open innovation and crowdsourcing. And this would be a place for you to go in and see some of the examples of what I'm talking about. So just to set it straight, I talk about the future of innovation the way I see it, and I see it's coming in three ways. It's definitely going to be open, but it cannot be open by itself. It has to be in a context that's also fast and global. I will not talk very much about the fast and global aspect on it, just a few hints of that. This talk will be very much about the open innovation part of it. And going to the fast part, something that I see right now and find very interesting is that in small companies, startups especially, and a trend driven out of Silicon Valley right now, is that it's very much about fail fast, fail often, rapid prototyping. How can you do things in beta mode all the time rather than going and trying to do everything the right way the first time? They try to experiment much more. This is something small companies can do easier than big corporations, but it's interesting to see that how this mindset has begun, still in its early phase, to actually spread to the bigger companies. And I think that's something we're going to see much more of in the future. We're going to see how big companies are going to try to copy these smaller ones in order to become faster with innovation. On the global part of innovation, it's actually quite simple, because if you look at the last 5-7 years, you can see all the multinationals. They used to have innovation centered around their headquarters in one given location. It's not really like that anymore. The big companies I interact with and work with, they are all over the place. For them, innovation is 24/7, and they have innovation hubs and actually some quite significant ones all over the world. But primarily in the BRIC countries like India and China, and to some extent now also building in Brazil, where I've been recently a couple of times. So let me try to go back to what's actually driving the open innovation part. And I would like to ask you a question, or just think about a question. That is, if we look at what it takes to really make innovation happen, it really requires knowledge. But the question is, where does this knowledge actually reside? And when I do this with my active audience, we usually have a small discussion on this one, but we pretty quickly agree that the main thing about knowledge is that it resides inside our heads. This is where it is, and this is a good thing, but it's also a bad thing, because it is quite difficult to get access for others to the knowledge we have inside our heads. But fortunately, in terms of open innovation, this is changing somewhat. And one key reason is the internet and how we see that tools like LinkedIn in particular has changed this one. And I assume, I hope that most of you are LinkedIn. And if not, if you really want to do open innovation and also think that to some extent open source, which is, by the way, something I'll touch upon, that the comparison similarities and differences, I'll touch upon that at the end of this presentation. But if you want to go in and really be open in your innovation process, I think a tool like LinkedIn is something that you need to utilize much more than what we see in the corporations today. And just to give you an example, and I usually show this actively when I do something, I ask someone in the audience, okay, give me a very specific term, something that you work on within your business, right, in your company, and give me something that's quite narrow and quite specific. And I get something. I have about 600 contacts on LinkedIn, and I have made it my policy only to link them with people I know or people I interact with. So it's a large group, but it's also a group that I know. It's not like I know 5,000 people on LinkedIn. But nevertheless, almost any given term they give me, within 10 seconds on this very specific term, I can find from 2,000 to 12,000 people. On LinkedIn, I can identify those people in just 10 seconds. And the thing is here that, yeah, we might not know these people, but we've actually taken a very big first step. We've been able to locate these people. And once we get to know where the people are, we can even identify them. We're getting pretty close to interact with them. And then we do not really know what's going to happen. Perhaps there's a link here. Now you've got reasons and you've got a way to actually get in touch with us. And that could be quite interesting. So the fact that knowledge resides inside our heads, and it's becoming easier to access, well, actually get in touch with people having this knowledge, is something that's really going to impact open innovation and the future of innovation in general. And if I move on to the next slide, I'm still thinking about an article I read about a year ago in which Gavin Horowitz, which is a quite successful vice president of Google, and there's this article where he said that I identified a list of about 200 people. Those are engineers around Silicon Valley that I would very much like to hire because those are great guys. And we need to get these guys on board for Google. And then he had an engineer that stopped him and kind of said, hey, think about this. Do we really need these people? And you can just read the text here because it's not necessarily about hiring all the right people. It's more changing in the sense that it's a question about having access to the right people. And I can back that up with another little story, and this one goes back a long time. And about 10 years ago, it's quite hard to believe, but the poster boy of open innovation, which is Procter & Gamble, they actually had some serious issues. They actually had a stock price that tanked. They had to fire the CEO. And the key reason was that their innovation output didn't come in anymore. The flow just stopped, and they had some difficulties really getting that back on track. And the new CEO, A.G. Lafley, he made some interesting things here. He went out and actually looked at, if you take a look at the people we have within our organization, within our R&D units, and we look at what they do and the qualifications they have, we can see that we have about 7,500 people. But taking those qualifications and profiles similar to these people, it'd be quite interesting to know how many people would be on the outside of P&G. And I asked this question, and people kind of range from, well, these are very high qualified people. So people say, well, something between 10, some say 1,000. But the number that P&G came up with was that for every one of their employees, there were 200 people on the outside with the similar qualification that could help do a similar job. But those people were not really on the payroll of PG. And this is where I can ask a quick question to many companies. What would an arrogant company do? An arrogant company would actually say what I just said, hey, who cares? They're not on our payroll. But PG was not arrogant. They looked at this as an opportunity. They looked at this and said, this is quite interesting. How can we actually go in and interact with all these people? And that kind of thinking, that kind of mindset helped them develop websites like, I cannot show you websites in this presentation, but go in and look at pgconnectdevelop.com, and you can get a pretty good idea on how companies that are very mature and open innovation are confident enough to share their needs and their knowledge and what they can bring to others as well. And it started from the mindset of saying that we're not arrogant. We really want to get in touch with the best people out there, and we understand that not all the best people can work for our company. So just some reflections here, and I often get the question, how do you define innovation? How do you define open innovation? And to be honest, I really try to avoid that question because If I ask anyone in the room with us, like 20 or 30 people or 100 or 200, I'll get at least 10, 15 definitions. So I usually say it doesn't really matter what people say they mean about innovation, how they define it. It doesn't matter what I say as a consultant, because it boils down to the specific company and their specific situation, and they need to develop their own definition of innovation. However, if I'm pushed to it, I would say that open innovation is about combining internal and external resources and being able, through a process, a structured process, to act on those opportunities. That's what I see as the key thing on open innovation. And open innovation is very much about management, organizational innovation. And it means that everyone within an organization, once it's fully spread within a company, everyone will have a role to play. Most companies do. Well, a very large majority still have a long way to go in this one. And I'm not saying that everyone should be innovative, at least not at the same time. But if you have a truly innovative organization that's still on open innovation, you will also have ways in which you can involve your people. The interesting thing about open innovation being very much about management organization is that it's very hard to copy. It can give you some very interesting competitive advantages, because the output you get of having such an organization is that you can bring interesting innovation to market faster. You get more speed and you get more diversity. And you'll see that when you start churning out products and services and your competitors look at it and say, what's actually going on here? How can they continue doing this? And then they'll find out it's not because they're just doing innovation. It's because they made innovation more part of the management organizational setup. And this is very difficult to copy. And companies that actually do this quite well, they gain a very interesting position, which we in the open innovation community call the preferred partner of choice. And here we need to think of that we need to look at businesses as ecosystem. It's no longer enough that you just have one company trying to develop anything by itself. It's more likely that one company have an idea and they bring in other partners and they work together to actually build an ecosystem that can bring this new product and service to market in a more fully fledged solution. And the thing here is it's difficult to assemble an ecosystem like that, but you also need to consider that ecosystem will actually clash against another ecosystem, the incumbents out there, the ones already serving the needs that you're trying to serve. And you have to fight not just one company when you bring your innovation to market. You have to fight another ecosystem. So getting the preferred partner of choice within an ecosystem actually means that your competitors will be given the leftovers on what you decide not to proceed further on. So I wanted to show a little video, and this is unfortunately not possible, but you will be given this presentation shortly after, and I would like you to go in and watch this one. Some of you might have seen it before. It's called Shift Happens. And it goes in and shows how fast pace of change we actually have right now. And it has some interesting and actually some quite astounding facts that really surprised me first time I saw them. And it kind of tells me two things. One is that the power is shifting in the world we have right now. I'm from Copenhagen, Denmark, and Denmark is a country that's really been doing well for many, many years, and we have a great living here. Quality of life is great here, and so is it in most of the Western world. But unfortunately for us and unfortunately for others, things are changing. The gravity of power is changing towards the emerging countries, and we need to fight very hard in the Western world to actually stop this. This is something that you can get a better feeling of by watching this video. And the other thing I see here is that companies are actually moving towards what we can call a creative destruction. And one reason is that the intensity of this fast pace of change can be a surprise, even though that people like us that work with the innovation, we're used to change, but the intensity is just getting faster and faster. And when I speak with people in my network groups, I've been running network groups for the last 7 years, bringing innovation leaders together and discuss in a peer-to-peer setting, we discuss issues at hand. And something we've been looking into recently is that about 30 to 40% of these companies have begun some kind of creative destruction. Either they learned that organization setup is just not suited for the world we have right now. The technologies need to change, or the business models need to change. And this really has an impact on innovation as well. And then there's something that's quite important, and surprisingly, many companies have not really understood this yet. That is, customers just don't care where innovation comes from. That means that that's not invented here culture, meaning that, hey, we can do everything ourselves in our company, and thus we don't need any external contribution. Well, perhaps you can bring out good products, but I'm going to bet almost everyone that your competitors that's taking a more open approach will be able to churn out better products and services than you. And this requires that corporate innovation people over time will become not just innovators based on their own internal capabilities, but they also need to become facilitators and integrators and being able to bridge the internal resources with the external resources. And then I can talk about that. We're going to see that if you as an individual want to really work in the future of innovation, you're going to need three things. You need a more holistic approach to innovation. You need to become a better networker, and you need to become a better communicator. And just in the holistic approach of innovation, there's two things I like to tap into. And the picture we're showing now is from Silicon Valley. It's a great place to visit, and I have many good friends there. One of them is Paul Campbell, a former vice president of Hewlett Packard. And I really like his take on what it would take to make a project a success within HP while he was there. And he said that an intrapreneur, someone who builds a business within a company, need to be able to see and pursue possibilities across a minimum of three or more business functions at the same time. This means it's not enough that you just make innovation happen within R&D. You need to include others, and not perhaps not just sales and marketing. You could also try to see if you can include supply chain, finance, or other business functions. You need a more broader view on this, a more holistic approach to innovation in order to make things that really can have a strong impact. I really like this slide, and it's based on work that is, hey, it's almost 10 years ago, that a company called Doblin, Doblin.com, a Chicago-based consultancy, they went out and actually looked at the state of product innovation. And they were very surprised to learn at that time that almost 96% of all product innovation failed. 96%, that's kind of ridiculous. It's a very high number, and I think it's lower today, but I'm also certain it's still very high. But Doblin actually took a very thorough methodological approach on this one and tried to find out why is this so. And what they actually found out is that if we look at this one under innovation efforts, where do we put our efforts on this one? And this is on the product. It says product performance here, and then the product system next to it. And this is where people actually put our efforts. But what about if we looked at the return on investment on innovation? And here we see that if we go back, where we put all our efforts, that's definitely where we do not get the value creation. And more interestingly, if we look at the finance, process, and delivery, which were part of what Doblin dubbed the 10 types of innovation. These are the 10 types of innovation. And you can read more about this one on Doblin with an O, Doblin.com, and you can see some good cases on how they define these different areas. But what I really like here is that it's not enough to just focus on a product or if you're a service company on the service alone. You also need to go in and see how you can get other elements of the business and business functions involved in your innovation process, because that's where you're going to get the value creation. Just to give you an example, when you see business model and finance to the far left, think of Dell Computers. Well, we all know that Dell Computers went out and actually built the business based on, you can do some very individual configuration of your computers. But the business model thing they really did that's quite interesting is that you paid up front. The last thing you did and actually do when you buy something online today is to pay with your credit card. But imagine doing this one as the first and one of the only companies out there. It meant that you actually got your money up front. And what happens if you pay your suppliers like 60 days later? The cash flow that Dell actually generated on this one funded the whole growth and made it possible for them to actually become the company it is today. Yes, they offered some uniqueness in terms of configuration, but this is actually what helped really create the company. You can go to the other side, look at delivery, channel, brand, and customer experience. And then I usually ask people if they have a Harley Davidson motorbike. And unfortunately, not that many say they do. But the thing about motorcycles, if you ask me, it's like two things. It's a lot of metal and it's a lot of technology put into a quite small object. I would not really be able to tell the difference from one motorbike from the other if they were not for one thing. What is it that really distinguishes Harley Davidson from other motorcycles? It's the sound. We can always hear when it's a Harley Davidson coming. This is actually a different way of innovating as well on things like this one, on the brand and on the customer experience, now here in the term of the sound. And quite interesting enough, and a surprise to many people, but did you actually know that Harley Davidson been trying to trademark that sound? They try to really protect this one because they understand this is a competitive advantage they have. They failed, but I think it's a quite interesting example on how you can actually innovate beyond just the product or service itself. I talked a little bit about ecosystem, and I'm supposed to just see the slide first, but some of you might have heard about electric car concept called Better Place. But just think about the electric car itself. What does it actually take to get out to market? It requires that you have car manufacturers actually getting ready for this. And you need battery manufacturers that can deliver something that's useful over a long run. You need battery charging stations. You need other services. This is a very good example of how difficult it can be to actually go in and create an ecosystem of partners. Now think about who they're actually fighting against. They're fighting against the big oil companies. And I think this is the most powerful competitor you can have today. And they're not willing to give up on the market they have right now. They might do some green initiatives, but, well, if you ask me, they're just doing this to show some goodwill towards the environment. But I'm quite sure when you look at a business startup, they prefer things to stay just as course they are. And as we talked about ecosystem, or I talked about ecosystem earlier, this is actually a very good example of ecosystem that you need to assemble and then clash against another ecosystem. Because the gasoline company is not alone. They produce the fossil oils, but then you also have the gas stations. Well, some of them are even owned by the oil companies. But you also have the car manufacturers. So ecosystem clashing against another ecosystem. So when I bring this one up, I ask people, what do you think this is? And people are getting more and more familiar with what we call organizational network analysis. And this is actually what it is. This is a network diagram. And I like this one because it can show two things here. This could actually be your company. This could be the four departments within your company. And you have, let's say that yeah, the big one could be R&D, and then you have the sales marketing on the up high, and you have telecommunications on the other hand. This could also be your industry. This could be four different companies and the people working within these companies. And the thing we need to pay attention to here is that we can see how interconnected those small units are, but they don't really connect with other units. And if you take the big one and you look in the middle, you can see there's a big dot in there. And that dot used to hold lots of power before. That's like the bottleneck of this company, for good or bad. It could be a positive bottleneck. It could also be a negative one. And this used to be the kind of people that really had all the opportunities and the power of these companies. But this is actually changing. And now if you take the upper one and you take the one that has a lot of connection outside his own group, his own unit, I'd say that's the person that's going to have a bright future ahead of him. Because that person's going to see many interesting opportunities and will be able to benefit, make his company benefit on this one, and also personally. So the power is actually changing for those who are more like the central connectors within a tight unit, and it's becoming a more interesting place to be if you're what you can call a broker, someone who can go across different units and different cultures and act on those opportunities. Unfortunately, many companies do not really act that well on networking efforts. And I remember a case some years ago with a fairly big Danish company with about 20,000 people. And I was speaking with, I was giving a talk for one of the executives and some of his people. It was one of the divisions he was running. And, well, we talked about this in the presentation. I got a good question. I said, well, can you see why it's important to actually go in and build a strong networking culture? Can you see that a networking culture will actually lead to a strong innovation culture? And he kind of said, yeah, I see this. There's something there in there. And yeah, it makes lots of sense. He said, and then I asked him, so what are you going to do about it? I kind of looked at him and said, well, I don't think I'm going to do anything about it. I was kind of baffled because he just kind of bought into the idea that a strong networking culture will lead to a strong innovation culture. So I asked him, why not? And then he said, well, things like this, they will take care of itself. And I'm sorry to say so, but that's just not true. I mean, you cannot expect people to become better networkers just by itself. It requires that you have a very strategic purpose and why you should network. And more importantly, a company needs to give the people some tools to network. And even more importantly, I think we can all agree that we have a small box up here saying that urgent. And urgent is unfortunately where most of us spend lots of our time. And, well, we just don't have more time to go out and network and build relationships. We already know how difficult it is to do this and actually also maintain strong relationships. So it's going to be very difficult to ask people already working at 100% to go out and become better networkers because we want to embrace open innovation. Companies need to get a more strategic approach to networking and make room for this. And unfortunately, it doesn't happen that often. The last thing was about communication. And I was recently at a conference in Chicago called the Open Innovation Summit. And that was yet another great conference in which you see companies share their insights and experiences on open innovation. And something that was the key was communication. It should be holistically, again, internal as well as externally. And when we talk about communication, we need to get away from the sense that this is just about the products and service you have and how you can market this. This should be behaviors and messages internally as well. And it should be more about just your product and service, which should also be about your corporate innovation capabilities. How can you become better at communicating on how good you are at innovation? How can you actually go in and use social media tools to go in and make some of your innovation people innovation thought leaders, someone who can bring more awareness to the corporate innovation programs you have? This is something companies are looking into right now, and this is also where I see one of the most interesting things right now on open innovation is how can we actually get open innovation mixed up with social media tools? Well, if you want to get some good ideas on what I also call the elevator pitch, which is the ability to actually sell a message. It's not selling a product or service, but it's about selling a message to a recipient that would enable you to actually have another meeting, a more longer meeting with someone in the near future. And imagine you only have 60 seconds to send this message. There's some keys that you need to look into. And here you can go in and get some inspiration on this site, elevatorspeech.net. It also has some very funny videos that you should check out. So the ability to communicate not only about your products and services, but also about your messages, your visions, your ideas, it's very important. And you need to do this internally as well as externally. Externally, especially when you start becoming more open and you need to meet with external collaboration partners. So I would assume that some of the questions that hopefully are going to drop in, and again, you can use the Twitter instruction that's given by Chris, and that is go in and use Twitter, and hashtag is OYWF. But some questions will probably be about open innovation versus open source, and what are the differences, similarities, and how can we learn and benefit from each other? And my personal view on this one is that yes, there are differences, there are similarities, but I think that the most important thing is that we do not know enough about each other. When I speak with people in the open innovation community, and we start talking about open source, we start thinking, hey, well, those are a bunch of IT technology guys, and they're kind of just doing everything, and they don't really make any money out of it. And that kind of mindset that's very prevailing within the open innovation community. And there's perhaps some truth to it, but that's also because you need to understand why companies embark on or embrace open innovation. I mean, if you look at this slide, it comes from Chris Grams, which I really liked. And he kind of says that if you go in and look at typical projects done the open source way, you have many beneficiaries and you have many contributors. But he's now contrasting this with crowdsourcing, but it's still kind of relevant to open innovation as well. Whereas the opposite on open innovation is that, hey, it's more about one company, and usually a big one, that's in control of an open innovation project. And this big company is trying as hard as it can to actually get as many benefits for itself as possible. At a recent conference, I also heard, and that's only half joking, a big company tried to explain how they view a win-win situation with smaller companies. And they kind of half jokingly and said, well, win-win for us is that we get to take the little guy twice. Big companies have a huge problem on actually sharing things with others. They really want to have everything for themselves, and they're really trying to change their attitudes on this one and try to become better at creating those true win-win situations. And I think that's something we can really learn from the open source community. It seems like the open source community is more about going and actually say, well, we've got some difficulties here. We've got some challenges and problems. How can we solve it? What if we do something together and we set it up in a way in which we can all actually benefit from this and all actually work together on this one? And even more important, we have lots of processes and legal documents that actually work here. But again, it seems like it's more towards the IT technology side. On the other hand, that's my view on it. It might be that I'm wrong here. It might be that you see that even business-to-business companies doing some kind of heavy machinery can go in and use the same concepts, ideas, and processes and tools that you develop within open source. That's my approach to you guys. If this is the case, let's see how we can find common ground. Let's see how we can actually start working together. And that's something that I would very much like to hear some comments on my website, or you can email me directly when I show you my contact information a little bit. Just shoot me some emails, and I would very much like to write some more blog posts about this and try to see how we can find out where the differences are, where the similarities are, and where we can find this common ground. And this is actually my presentation, and I hope that even though it's a very one-way way of doing this, that you've got some insights that you can use, and we can also go to some discussions. And yes, I do also work in this field called urgent. I have lots of things to do, and I'm forcing too many things, but I really like to interact with others. And if you have any questions or comments, just feel free to shoot me an email. I can try to help you. If I cannot help you directly, I know lots of people and lots of resource places where I can point you to a place where perhaps you can get some information what you're looking for. But then again, thank you very much for listening in, and I think we should open up for a discussion. And Chris Grams, are you there?
Yes. Great. Thank you very much, Stefan. We've got some questions already for you, and just as a reminder to folks who'd like to ask a question, you can ask your question by sending the comment to the moderator on the webcast using private chat. The moderator is the attendee open source way. Just do a private chat to them, or you can do it via Twitter using the hashtag #OYWF. So, Stefan, the first question for you is, it seems that the freemium business model is starting to take hold. Do you think this model will exist over the long run, say 10 years or so?
Which business model?
The freemium, like F-R-E-E.
I read the book by Chris Amos myself. It's quite interesting, this one. And I think that what we're seeing right now is that everything that lies in the middle of something is going to have some difficulties. Either you have a premium product, or you have something that kind of goes for free, and you find different ways of actually making money on this one. So I think we've already seen quite some development here. I think it's going to continue even further. And it also brings me to something on innovation itself. I advise companies to go out and actually focus on two things, two kind of innovation that's very important. And one is that you need to neutralize your competitors. Imagine that your competitors actually go out and do something that's quite unique, and that could be, for instance, no-frill airlines. See how mess they created for the established airlines, and they had to find a way to neutralize this one. It could also be about 10 years ago when we saw the first net banking initiatives. How could the established banks actually go out and neutralize this one? That is very important. You need to go out and neutralize competitors. And the other thing is that shoot for the stars. Try to see if you can build something that you can really attach a premium to, something that could be the opposite of the freemium, something where you can really go in and say, this is going to be good, and we're going to have some advantages for a fairly long time. Apple is a very good example here. But I think that when it comes to premium and freemium, I think things that are in the middle really need to be careful not becoming roadkill. And actually, the same goes when you look at innovation. You need to neutralize others, or you need to go for the premium. You need to shoot for the stars.
Great. Thank you, Stefan. The next question, wondering what kind of advice you might have for a company that is strong in working with communities outside the company, so doing open innovation outside the company, but not so great about establishing them internally.
Well, sometimes I'm a bit direct, but I would say they should stop immediately doing what they're doing right now. There's no reason to go out and build up relationships with external companies if you cannot make innovation work internally. Imagine what's going to happen when we really start engaging with partners on a serious level, and you're actually going to do this with many partners, and you cannot make things work internally. It's going to be a complete mess. It's going to be very complex to bring in external partners to your innovation process. And that complexity, it's going to be a mess if you're not sure how to make things work internally. And it's surprising how often I see companies come out and say that, well, we cannot really make innovation work internally. And then see others to open innovation, they can't say, hey, we need to do the same thing here. It's like a holy grail. And we just need to do this and everything will be fine. It's also saying this, but that's a serious mistake to make.
Great, thank you. The next question is actually a comment and a question. To me, the similarity between open innovation and open source is that they are both hard sells. Overcoming the objections to things like the old adage, you get what you pay for, is very difficult. My organization has multiple overlapping software packages that cost very big dollars and do less than a single open source software package. Plus, there is very huge bureaucracy in place that resists any tiny change, let alone innovation. How is it possible to overcome this and remain sane?
If things stay like this, I think we're going to see a company like that is just going to go belly down. It's going to go down at some point. If there's no willingness to change, I think they're going to be overtaken by the new ways of doing business, especially if it seems like it's also a very bureaucratic company. The key thing is, and I meet this quite often when I work with innovation leaders, innovation directors in charge of these initiatives, and it's very difficult for them to actually do anything about this if they're not able to get the top management on board. I always say that if you really want to make innovation work, you need to follow what we call the TPX model. And the T stands for top down. Nothing will ever happen. No changes will come along if you do not have your top executives with you. And the same goes, nothing will happen if you do not have the bottom up. The people, you need the organization with you. And more importantly, you also need to have the middle managers involved. That's the X. The middle manager is what goes across an organization. What do you do if you do not have the top managers here? Well, hopefully you get some very strong people in charge of innovation that can go in, convince the executives and educate the executives on innovation and how this should change. Well, if this is not working either, I think you're going to see that at some point the company will be in trouble and you're going to get a burning platform, and then hopefully something will happen. And the thing is, whether if you are a very innovative person, wants to really see things change for the better, the question you need to ask yourself is, do you really believe that this company can turn around its mindset? And if not, then I would advise you to consider other options.
Okay, our next question. What would be an important message for a grad school educator of an open source course that would communicate the open innovation principles to students? So just to clarify, it sounds like somebody is teaching an open source course in grad school, and they want to be able to talk about open innovation. How would you do that?
Yeah, and the question I would like to ask here is, what kind of classes, what kind of students is this? Well, if it's business students, I think they will already be exposed to open innovation in other ways. But if this is a more technical course, IT technical related students, I think it's very important that you start building in the business aspects that are more prevailing in open innovation than in open source. It might be in the sense that, and it's not necessarily a good thing because, I mean, open innovation is more cutthroat business than what you might see in open source where you can have a more idealistic approach to it. And yet our knowledge, you still can make money there. But I think that it's important that we give or expose students of any kind with a very broad understanding of innovation, because we cannot go out and tell them that this kind of innovation or open source will be the only way you can make things happen or the only way you will be able to bring change for the better. You need to find combinations, and I think that educator will need to find some good cases and go and explain this one on a very simple level, and then more go in and act as a facilitator and provide access or guide these students to places, resource places where they can find more information on this.
Okay, thank you. I've got another question. One of the tenets that's talked about as part of the open source way is rapid prototyping. Do you see examples of rapid prototyping often in the open innovation world as well, and what do they look like?
We already see that, because what's going to happen is that you see companies being able to interact with external partners. Something just happened as about kind of cut off. Okay, we've seen this one. So what would ideally happen is that you get more diversity in your innovation process. And getting more diversity means that you need to be able to act faster, otherwise you're going to have a clogged up process at some point. So I think it's coming more naturally that when we really open up, you need to speed up your processes, and that will better open up for fail fast, fail often, and rapid prototyping. I think it's going to be a fairly natural step for companies that are maturing on open innovation. Because, I mean, one of the key reasons for doing open innovation is speed and faster access to market. It kind of implies the whole idea of open innovation once you get to work with the more mature ones.
Great. And here's a question actually from me, Stefan. In your book, you talk about jumpstarting innovation within a company, and you use this term proof follows perception, and you say that perception is everything. Can you elaborate a little bit more on what you meant by that?
We also see that the companies, or more likely the CEO, is trying to say that this company is very innovative and actually try to talk up how innovative it is. And to some extent, I believe this is actually a good approach, but you also need some substance to it. But the proof for all perception is that if you first build the perception and you tell your employees that they're not going to become innovative, we are already innovative, and you can show some good examples within your company that you are already innovative and doing some good stuff here, they can kind of buy into that and say, yeah, that's actually right, and they can pat their shoulder and say, hey, we're actually doing a good job on innovation. They can start talking to their family and friends and say, hey, we're a good innovative company here because of this and this and this, and present some examples of this one. So you start building the perception that you are innovative, but it might be based just on fairly few examples, and you need to expand that even further to go in and make sure that the proof actually follows the perception. But it's just so much easier to go out and do this if you do not have to convince an organization that they have to become innovative, but they already are innovative. They just need to improve on certain areas.
Thanks. And I have another question here. I'm a core member volunteer of an organization called Crisis Commons. Part of our mission is to build an ecosystem of technology and crisis response organizations across private, public, and academic areas. We're looking to spec out ideas around building an innovation lab. What would be some of your guidance?
Well, on Innovation Lab, I think one of the key things here is to really think hard about the people you bring into a place like that. And also whether those people need to come from the inside or the outside, or what kind of combination you can have of inside, outside. But most, we often see that the companies or organizations look at the products and services they need to involve and the strategic focus on this one, but they tend to forget about getting the right people on board. That's something that I write about in my book a lot as well. How do you actually identify and develop the right people that you need to work with innovation? And I think that once you start setting something like that up, go in and make sure you have some very strategic reasons for it. And once you've got that in place, go in and see which people you actually need to achieve those strategic goals, rather than just jumping into it and assuming that the people you already have a hand can just suddenly adapt and have a more innovation process mindset that will help you reach that.
Well, thanks very much, Stefan. This has been enlightening, and we appreciate you taking the time to do this webcast. For those who joined today, we actually already have an article up right now on opensource.com with the notes from the session and the slides as well, so you can go download those on the business channel. In addition, we'll be following up with a link to being able to watch the webcast again if you'd like to go back and check anything out shortly. So thanks again, everyone, for attending, and have a great rest of your day.
Thank you very much.